welcome back to the DefendoCast with your erstwhile Flash Flashcast ensemble. I am Lisa Schmeiser, and with me as always are Phil Mosalak.
I like ensembles.
Yes, and Tony Sindelar.
I guess I like ensembles.
Oh. Ensemble, ensemble.
It's all I don't know. I was French. Told there'd be less quizzes in this episode. So
I was told this podcast was in English. Anyway, we are here to discuss episode 5 of The Defenders today, which picks up pretty much at the exact second that episode 4 ends. And we are here to discuss such fun things such as what happens if all 5 fingers of the hand appear in an episode, whether or not where Danny is in the continuum of iron fists and intelligence, and whether or not the black sky is really the empty vessel that the people in the hand hope she really is. So long-time listeners and new listeners will know that we have a typical format for these episodes where we do a super quick recap, hopefully less
that was a heck of a recap, though.
Yeah. I hadn't like you just started did. Yet.
I mean, you're priming the recap pump. So
exactly. Yeah. Anyway, we can do a really quick recap, and then we will discuss what stood out for us in the episode, what we liked, what we didn't like, and what we think it means in the series as a whole, since we have 5 whole episodes to chew on now. All right. So, all right, let me know when I need to start, because I am doing the recap, and the goal is to get done in under 60 seconds.
Yeah, so 60 seconds, that's your goal, but, you know, sometimes you take more than 60 seconds. I think, you know, by Flashcast standards, more than 90 seconds is unacceptable. So,
oh no!
All right, Lisa, I'm going to give you...
In Arrowcast, like, basically what we're doing, it looks like a fly.
I'm unclear if they know what the word recap means.
No, they really don't.
When I did it and I finished my recap... Because they were gracious enough to have me on this past summer for a couple episodes. And when I did my recap and I nailed it in under 2 minutes, there was this long pause. They're like, we've never had that happen.
You come into our house and do that? Exactly. I'm really
How
enjoying
dare you.
The Arrowcast is recapping Arrow Season 1 this summer, which I have been also watching to listen along with the recaps. It is a lot of fun, but they do take longer, and including I just listened to an episode where it's only 2 of them, and somehow it's 20 minutes longer than average, so... Calculate from that what you will about group dynamics on the Arrowcast. But anyway, I've distracted you, Lisa, which is part of my strategy. Okay. I'm going to give you my strategy to have you recap. I was like, we were at war with the Arrowcast. Now I'm at war with everybody. This is not the teamwork that we expect from the Defenders. I'm going to give you a 5-5 count if you are ready.
All right, let's do it.
All right, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
At the beginning of the episode, it looks grim because it looks like Luke Cage, the heart of the Defenders, has been taken captive by Sawande, the African warlord, immortal dude who's part of the hand. Turns out instead that Luke managed to best Sawande, brings him back as a hostage, where he shows that he's got the same interrogation surviving skills that Madame Gao actually demonstrated in an episode of Iron Fist. The episode does not end well for Sawande, and we find out that the hand will stop at nothing to get the Iron Fist, Danny Rand. Sawande also gets off my favorite line of the episode, which is, you may be the dumbest Iron Fist yet, and I will explain why I love that line so much later. Also back, like a bad boyfriend, is Bakudo, who comes back, negs Colleen Wing harder than an entire Reddit board full of pickup artists could possibly hope to do, stabs her in the stomach for good measure, and then runs off to try to convincing his fellow fingers that no, he's totally on top of things. It's really cool. We also see that Misty Knight is now concerned enough about what's going on where she takes Luke's advice and helps round up all of the loved ones of the Defenders. So there will be some amusing meets and greets in a little room in the back of the NYPD. What is the other big thing that happens in this episode? Also, it looks like Elektra's getting some memories back. The end.
Nice.
Did you just say, like, basically for, like, minions of the hand, you called them fingers?
Yes.
I think you said that, right?
I think so, yeah.
It's pretty awesome. I mean, I wasn't even ready for that, and I was like, That makes so much sense. No one's ever made this a thing.
So, Lisa, I clocked you at 1 minute, 29 seconds, and 51 whatever is a fraction of a second. So, just under the minute.
I shouldn't have put in the slam. So, I shouldn't have put in that slam about the pickup artist. So.
It's, you know, I think it was worth it. So, I support your choice.
No, this is...
The Russian judges are mixed on it, but, you know.
Guys, did this episode kick off, like, with a weird comic tone with the classical music and the assembling of the enemies?
So I looked it up. It's a Brahms symphony, which I thought was disappointing because it was Schubert that, I believe it was Schubert that Alexander references in, like, episode two. But, well,
I thought for half a second I had a Mel Brooks movie.
Yes,
happening.
I did too. That was the thing is you see it happening where Sawande is riding along in his van with his war court, I guess. Is that what a warlord has as a war court? So he's riding along with his buddies, all of whom love sharpening knives and holding guns and looking impressive. And then you see Madame Gao with her gun squad. And you see, I can't remember the name of the Japanese member of the hand. I'm so sorry.
Murakami, I think. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly.
But you see,
it's somewhere in there.
You see him running along all by himself on a rooftop because I guess he is a ninja who works in light and shadows. And
classical Renaissance, and, yes.
Well, yes. That's what they do.
And all I could think is for a moment, you kind of expect Bugs Bunny to come in wearing a Brunhilde helmet. I mean, it's just the music doesn't help that.
It doesn't play right, no.
But you know who is noticeably absent from that whole confrontation scene is Alexandra. Until the very end, when it actually goes pretty bad for them. And then, because, you know, the fight happens, and Elektra and Matt have their moment where he almost gets through to her, and you can tell that she's just about to, wait, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? I have this dude here who's talking to me like I'm a human being and not a weapon. And then Murakami comes out and barks at her in Japanese, and somehow the spell is broken. And Alexandra's just watching it all from a white SUV, which is, of course, completely discreet. And at that moment, I'm like, why did Gao not just, like, open fire on her? I would have been so irritated where it's my people and my forces on the line, and she does nothing.
Yeah, she went into that hard and then, like hidden, and then she exited super hidden as well. It was odd.
It was. I think this fight scene kind of flopped for me. And it's hard because that fight scene in episode 3 was just so great and was really well choreographed, and it was kind of easier to follow what was going on. This one was, I think, overly hectic. And I think it was supposed to be hectic because we have these kind of new boss characters that have been introduced, and you've got some of the hand operatives are kind of watching and not engaging. And we're seeing Murakami in action for the first time. And you know, I think the characters themselves don't quite know what's going on because, like, Matt breaks off from the group and they're like, what is Matt doing? And they think Luke has been captured when Luke has not been captured. And so it's chaotic, but it's a little all over the place. And it wasn't, I don't know, I didn't super enjoy watching it. And I there's the big question of the hand, kind of, what are the power levels of the hand characters?
Uh-huh.
And we brought that up last episode and said we got to save that for this episode. Because it feels like they're all over the place and it's not consistent. And I know you got to fudge stuff a little bit for story here and there. And, you know, like... I don't know. The defenders have been, they've been up for like 48 hours. So like maybe they're not all, but like, like Luke Cage is fighting one of the leaders of the hand and they seem to be like evenly matched. And like, I kind of struggled with that. Cause I was like, I thought the whole idea is like Luke Cage is not a great fighter. He just can't be hurt. Right.
Yeah.
Well, now wait a minute, because now I saw Luke Cage at the, I forget when, what show it was. Maybe it was Luke Cage. And he had a cinder block, like a big one that he was lifting to move rubble.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute. So he's not just like his skin isn't just interlocking
super
and super
strong. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
But
he's not
was
fast.
Was that a thing?
Yeah. But he's not fast and he's fighting ninjas.
And he's not a skilled fighter. This is the thing that I enjoyed the fight scenes because I like a good fight scene and this was fun. It wasn't as much fun as episode 3, which I thought was really elegant and well lit. And my complaint about the fight scene here there are two things. The one thing that I liked was the lighting does shift depending on who's fighting. So mm-hmm. you could kind of tell who the focus is going to be on, because if the light's more golden, it's Luke. And if the light's more red, it's Matt. And if the light's more green, it's Danny. So, you know, kudos to them for keeping up the consistent color associations. But otherwise, it's a really dark and somewhat hectic and confusing fight scene. I did like that, but Luke and Jessica really seem to be fighting well.
Yes.
And the fact that she's up against a lot of people who know martial arts and she does not, like, they should have had her flat on her back and made taking her out a big priority. And mm-hmm. that doesn't happen. See, so
I thought she had the strength and Luke didn't. Luke nope. is just impenetrable.
Yeah. He's got the strength too. So
he does.
Yeah. Okay. In fact, I think she's kind of mysterious about her strength. I would be willing to believe that she is stronger than him and just doesn't kind of advertise that. But they both have heightened strength. They both have superhuman strength, it seems like, right?
It must be booze and snarkiness and anorexia that make her stronger.
Well, no, it's that she's, you know, a superhuman.
Gotcha.
But also,
because
Murakami is here, so it seems like we've got four of the five hand leaders are present in this room, but it doesn't feel like that, mm-hmm. right? And maybe that was a mistake especially because in the last episode, Stick basically tells us, like, oh yeah, the one hand leader you haven't met, he's the worst. And it's like, is he? Like, this is our first meeting of him. And I guess, I guess he's intimidating because he doesn't have a gang with him and he alone is a weapon. But like,
and he loves to kill endangered predators. Like, that's the other thing we know about him is he's like, oh, there's like three things left in the world and I hunted and killed one. And I'm like, asshole, pardon my language, but dude, you're a jerk for killing these animals.
And the thing is, he's just playing with the guts. Like, I didn't understand what you were doing. Like, you're field dressing it.
I thought
apartment building.
Maybe. I mean, why did you kill a bear in Japan to bring it to New York City to butcher it? I don't know. I assume
reasons.
Maybe he's going to taxidermy it or something, but that just seemed like that's a tropey way to introduce a villain, is somebody is like, you know, they're torturing somebody or they're butchering an animal. They do that with, it's a pretty good opening in, I think the first time we see Tywin Lannister in Game of Thrones, he is like butchering like a stag, and it's symbolic because he's going up against the people who have the stag as their like logo, as their coat of arms. But it's also showing like, this is a villain who gets their hands dirty and is tough and menacing and spends their free time like up to their elbows in blood.
You know, and I don't like to catch plot holes, but like the way in which it read, and this is, I think, the problem I was having with, is they kept saying, you know, Stick was talking about this person you haven't met.
Yes.
Now, we had seen him with Alexandra. The person we didn't see was the real suave guy.
Bakudo?
That's Bakudo. So he's from Iron Fist.
That's Bakudo. Yes. He's from Iron Fist. And
not read as a guy that I'm scared of.
The great thing about him, and this is, and I think it helps if you watched Iron Fist, but basically the reason I find him particularly menacing is he was really good at getting inside, say, Colleen's head in Iron Fist and everyone else's head. He was really good at abusing trust and then gaslighting people with, oh, you think the hand is really bad, but we're not. We have a school where we take in orphans and we give them life skills and we give them a family and a community to be proud of. And, he's like, well, I realize that you think the hand is filled with evil people, but we're like the philanthropic part of the hand, and everybody else is just really unsavory. And I'm so sorry that they've given you a bad impression. And then he turns out to like turn on a dime, which is, you know, terrifying, because it's the human nightmare where somebody you trust turns out to know all your weaknesses and then will not hesitate to use them against you the minute you cross them. And so when he comes back and does this to Colleen with what basically amounts to the, girl, we were so good together, it hurt me when you broke up with me. Because it was basically like, he was like the ex who slides into your mentions the day before you're supposed to get married. And he's like, I had always thought it was going to be you and me. Sigh. It's too bad. Sigh. I mean, maybe we'll reach your potential with this guy, but I know what we could have been. Sigh. Like that is Bakudo to a T as a member of the hand. And
I think he does come across in this episode as very creepy. He does not come across as like particularly intimidating, like physically or in his performance. And I guess, you know, to fill you in, Mose, a little bit from Iron Fist, he's kind of one of the kind of antagonists. It's a little confusing in Iron Fist, and it is established that basically he is running, So the Hand has operatives from different parts of the globe. He's from South America, and he is in Iron Fist. He is running like a Hand kind of academy in like
He's Island. Like, again, he's basically the philanthropic arm where he's like, I take care of orphans and we create a family together.
And maybe he is the one training the ninjas for the Hand, right? Like, because Madagascar seems to run a drug operation. He seems to be in charge of like recruitment and training. And there is this kind of confusing plot in Iron Fist where like Bakuto is like, oh yeah, I am part of the Hand, but it's not the same Hand as Madame Gao. She's evil. She's real bad.
Yeah.
And it's legitimately confusing in Iron Fist. Like, what is going on? Is this guy, like, does he actually believe that or not? And in fact, in Iron Fist, I am unclear what the character believes. I feel like in Defenders, we accept that, like, that is just a lie he's telling to whoever needs to hear it at the moment.
Well, I feel like the whole thing, so it's basically the whole theme to Iron Fist is what to do when your trust is betrayed. Like, that is at the heart of every single plot. It's between Danny and the people that he thought were his family. It's between the people, the siblings that discover and their dad. It's between Colleen and Bakuto. It's between Danny and Colleen at one point. It's basically like the whole series is about learning who you can trust and what to do when you discover you've been betrayed. And so having Bakuto come back and like reprise his greatest hits and then try to like, you know, gaslight Madame Gao and everybody else, which nice job. They're onto you. I loved it because I'm like, it's Bakuto's greatest hits. But I can see if you haven't watched Iron Fist, I can see where you're like, who is this turkey? Why is he doing a mediocre Javier Bardem imitation?
Also,
I don't understand
it. It's hard. Maybe I just consume way too much vampire media, but I can't take any of these guys, I'm an immortal, I'm so badass lines seriously. When he says, I tried death, it didn't take. It's like, oh, poor Bakuto, you practiced that in the car like 10 times before you said it to Colleen, and I'm still not buying it. It's just,
here's the,
you know.
Yeah, the issue that I have with that guy, and like the character that you guys are talking about sounds awesome.
But you didn't see that guy in episode 5.
Because what did I see? I saw the guy from Transformers, like, 2 or 3.
Was he in a Transformers movie?
Oh, yes, he was. He was the guy that, like, was trying to, like, get... He was friends with Shia LaBeouf. I think he was, just, like, his roommate or something. When Shia goes to college and then makes out with, the girl Transformer. I think that's him. And it's just one of those things where it's like,
I now know more
cast.
About Transformers 2 than I needed to, but continue.
Yeah.
Right. But anyway, that particular actor. So again, this is a casting thing. That character sounds awesome on paper, as this kind of, almost like date rapist meets Hand executive.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, but he was not.
Yeah. I may be one of the few people to have benefited from watching the Iron Fist because this whole sequence just delighted me. So I enjoy hearing it from the perspective of people who didn't are like, what? Because there's
he's,
that.
He's also, I feel like, I mean, they haven't done a lot with Murakami yet, but Bakuto seems kind of like the weakest in terms of intimidation of the five, right? I mean,
right.
You know, we see Bakuto butchering a bear. They don't do we get a little bit more with Suwande in this episode than we have before. But like Alexandra and Madame Gao are great supervillains that like I take seriously. And Bakuto is it's hard to compete with Madame Gao, right? And Alexandra gets basically free points because Madame Gao is deferential to her, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I freaking love Madame Gao. I love her so much. And this episode...
Except if she talks too much, if she starts talking a little bit too much, it kind of reveals her fragility slightly. Yeah. But what was interesting is learning that there is strife within this upper echelon of the Hand.
Yes.
Where she's like, no, you're afraid of death, but the rest of us just want to go home. And the reason I like that line so much is it suggests that the rest of them are kind of grieving Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
And maybe they've been working their whole lives to try to get back something, a foolish decision, right?
Yeah.
And you know, you mentioned her fragility and Mose, and I think the thing that I like about that is she's substantially older than everybody else. And I want to know why. I want to know why. Like, I want to know if like she goes longer between revivals, or if this is like some punitive thing, or if she was older when she left and it was, and like, basically I want to find out why they all left and, and what is the deal with the disparity in ages that they have going on there? But, you know, I was paying attention to what the members of the Hand were wearing. And you kind of knew Sawande was a goner because he was in drabs. And the rest of them were all wearing different shades of gray and black, you know, even Alexandra. And it was interesting to see how they're all visually tied into each other and their surroundings that way. Because when Alexandra's facing them and she's wearing like that olive greeny blouse and the silver skirt, everybody that she's looking at is basically wearing the same outfit in a shade of gray and a shade of black. It's just a question of whether it's the top or the bottom, that's which color. And they look like a unified front against her. And it was just a really nice staging. I loved looking at that and rewinding it, looking at it again. And then when Alexandra goes to find my child, as she insists on calling the black sky, like when she opens the door and it looks like she's just opened the door to a very chic Berlin hotel. And you're
another shot of her through a mirror in that scene. Also,
there it is.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tony mirror theory.
And she's gone. But what's really interesting is, you know, Alexa, why do I call her Alexa? That's totally not her name. Electra goes back to Matt's loft. And she's wearing her black coat with the red lining inside, and she completely ties into Matt Murdock's surroundings in a way that she doesn't visually tie into any part of the complex she's being kept in with at the Hand.
Oh, I totally, like, I did not realize the black coat with the red lining, like that's totally a symbolism thing, right? The black coat, which we frequently just see the black part of it, that's the black sky, and every now and then we see a little bit of the red lining underneath, which is the like the
it's Electra. Daredevil.
Yeah,
it's, yeah, or, it's Electra, or Electra,
and like, her old life is still there. It's covered up, but it's still there.
Nice. And Matt has
I thought it was very sweet, though, when she did, you know, kind of spoon up into his bed. Yeah. I was just like,
And his bed is gray, and he's got a gray carpet, just like, just basically just like she has in her quarters in the hand. But when she goes through his house and she runs past, she like walks past his sofa has a red and black plaid throw on it. And I'm like, oh, there's your visual cue. She belongs here. She's tied to it. And like with this episode, they did a great job of showing over and over again which characters belong where and which characters feel left out.
Speaking of left out, I do, you know, there's an interesting theme and an interesting kind of maybe foretelling from Murdock on the last episode, which is, you know, they're going to come after the people we love.
Yeah.
And this happens to be the one where they assemble all those people that are, well, the B team, but you know, these are the people that they
care
protect,
about. Yeah.
That they, and then who is the, I guess if Luke is going to be the father, then Misty can be the mother because bring on Misty Knight, who has the NYPD on her back to say, okay, bring them all in. We'll put them in a room, which now without going too far ahead, I kind of hated that they put them all into a room because, folks, they kind of stay there a while, which is a little ridiculous. But I did like that there's
a chance to mix and match.
Yes.
So I have to say the one scene that irritated the living crap out of me was when Matt goes to try to convince I'm blanking on the character, Deborah Ann Wool.
Claire? No, not Claire, Karen.
Yeah, thank you. That's it. I was like, here's the actress. When Matt's trying to convince Karen to get out of her office and go into protective custody, like, she is just flat out, like, tremulous. And she honestly sounds like she has been flying for hours off of too much coffee or something. She's really disjointed, and it's distraught, and it's weird, especially given their earlier conversation in an earlier episode where they're both like, well, we're taking some time and this is super awkward, but here we go. And
she goes, snaps right off on him. Is like, oh, now you want to be Daredevil again? It's like, hey, calm it down, you know, just a bit. I mean, I'm trying to save things and then you're going to be mad at me.
Yeah. I mean, well, this is the thing that I probably have with both Karen and Foggy, however, is they're sort of creating a dilemma where there shouldn't be any, where, you know, oh no, not Daredevil, please don't go put the suit on and go back out again. And you're like, really? you can't see that this is, you know, this is kind of what he's made to do. This is what
is this set in the larger Marvel world or not? If there's a lot of caped superheroes running around saving the world from threats that are actually pretty dangerous and bad, like, it seems, you know, the world seems, it seems a little bit crazy if you're the one Batman, but like, if there's 10 Batmans per city, you know, like, you know, that helps a little bit, right? But it's, and like, they keep referring to it as like, he's doing the thing again. And it's like, it's a little heavily coded as like, alcohol or drug addiction, right?
Yeah, but it's weird, it's because totally
it doesn't fit with Edward. Like, nobody else super, right? Nobody's like, Danny Rand's a ninja again. He's like, yeah, Danny Rand's always a ninja. So, like, nobody else is like, Danny Rand, stop being a ninja.
Like, Matt's some sort of thrill seeker. Like, it's never been like that. Yeah. He's never been, like, you know, like, addicted on the adrenaline or anything like that.
No, he's like, not beating up people for the kicks. He's doing it because his conscience drives him to, and his real problem is that he enjoys it too much. Like, and just the way that Karen and Foggy seem to treat it in the series, where they're like, do you need a sober companion to make sure that you're, you know, you're 5 days without putting on the suit? Like, it's... I find it to be fundamentally disrespectful of who he is.
It feels very out of sync with everything else that's going on, right?
It's like, right? Yeah.
I need to be Daredevil. There's an army of ninjas taking down New York City. Like, this is real. This is happening, people.
Time to go.
So that scene where he's trying to talk Karen into everything, and she's like, ah, and I was like, oh, Karen, dial it back. Just come on. You know, if you're a reporter who's in New York City, as you allege to be, and you can see what's going on, then what you should be more concerned.
And she seems to have worked her way up, right? She's got her own office. It's pretty nice looking. There's all kinds of stuff on the walls. She took over her dead
friend's office. Yeah.
Well, no, but that seems to be like her office now, right? It's not.
Well, she took over Ben Urich's office. That's all the decorations, because those pictures are there from his, from when he had it. Like, she's.
I thought it was basically moved in. I thought the idea was that she had moved up, and this was like, because I thought it was a different set, but I may be totally misremembering it.
Yeah.
In my head, she has gone and is now like her own. Like, she's a name, but maybe she's still just trying to fill in for the hole that Ben Urich left in the world.
But what I really enjoyed, now that I've carped about Karen and how none of that makes sense, what I really enjoy is that when Jessica barges in and grabs Trish out of a business lunch where Trish is very clearly pitching herself, like, Trish is not furious with her. She tries to do like a little desultory smoothing over, but like, she definitely does not question what's going on, and she's like, okay, whatever you do. All right, you know, fine, loopy best friend. Yeah.
Trish remembers the events of Jessica Jones, whereas Karen, like, apparently, Karen maybe, you know, she was not following all of the events of Daredevil season 2. So,
well, Karen's also waiting for Frank Castle to come back. That's what her big deal is.
You know, I feel like Claire, weird stuff happens. Claire is like, here we go again. Seems like some of them are a little bit more real. You know, I think they are writing Karen as if she exists in the real world. And Claire and other people know that they live in a Marvel world and things are crazy. And when somebody says, there's ninjas coming, we should go the other way around the block. You go the other way around the block.
Because you're like, of course. Why would there not be ninjas? There are always ninjas in New York.
Yeah. So I've got an app that tells me where the nearest ninjas are. So.
Absolutely. Oh my God,
that would be the greatest. Well, it's really counter
to the nature of ninjas is the problem. So. You know.
Well, like, that would be like the greatest through line in Rand Corporation season 2, where somebody like pitches their venture fund on, no, we have an app to show you where the location of ninjas are in New York. Mm-hmm. And they're always like, but no. And like, no, you don't understand. Ninjas have become a problem. They keep pulling all this statistical data and eventually like they persuade someone to fund it. Like, that would be the greatest throwaway through line plot.
You know, if they had their act together, they would sabotage that project. But it's really unclear.
Or they would launch that project and keep the data.
And then corrupt the data. So, I mean, that brings me to one of my questions about this episode is, what are we supposed to infer about the hand? Because things seem a little so they're out of magic stuff for reviving people, and that's a problem if you have been immortal for centuries and count on being revived. There now seems to be some infighting. We have the kind of nice scene toward the end where there's basically the superhero meeting and the supervillain meeting happening at the same time. And there's and there's squabbles among each other about information. But we kind of have three of the five hand are turning on Alexandra because they don't really like her plan. But like my big question is again, there's the whole power level thing, because we have basically two fights in this episode. One that we don't see, where Luke Cage takes down Sawande and captures him. And, like, again, I had a hard time with that one, because, like, Sawande is theoretically in the running for top five ninjas in the world.
Right.
And so, I'm willing to believe that Luke Cage is, like, impossibly strong and tough, and Sawande could not beat him, but, like, they could, like, they would be a draw. But you know what ninjas should be really good at? Is getting away. And that does not happen. And then later, we have, and I know this is a stupid nerd thing to complain about. It's like, why was Hulk so much sicker in episode, you know, in issue 295? He should have been easily able, he shouldn't have lost that arm wrestling fight with Ant-Man. That makes no sense, as established in this issue of Ant-Man, where Ant-Man arm wrestles this guy.
Well, but like, actually.
But Maram. Yeah,
that is the greatest "well, actually" I've ever heard.
Yes,
and also the most accurate.
But we also where Jessica Jones is fleeing with Trish, and they're running away. And who shows up?
I forget. Murakami.
Murakami shows up, and like briefly,
and like he can apparently fly, because like when they knock him over the wall and then look down, he's disappeared. So like,
I'm okay
where
with
has
that.
He gone?
That's a ninja vanish. I'm totally okay with that. What I was not okay with is like, how does he like stand up to Jessica Jones for even a second, such that Jessica needs to be saved by Matt? Like, it's, I mean, again, this guy is supposed to be like the worst ninja in the world, and I don't know.
He kills endangered species for fun. Why can't he kill Jessica with a slap of a wrist?
Or why is Daredevil enough that he has to run from that? Right? I guess it's you know, I'm unclear.
Well, like, he has to come back and expose it, because he goes and he has the meeting, and he's like, we have another problem with the Black Hand, and that problem is Daredevil. And the reason Daredevil's a problem is because he's her ex. And everyone's like, pfft. And he's like, no, this is going to be a thing. Trust me. And
this whole trust level is exactly, this is probably one of my, I understand it from a story, and we can't trust you because she was your girlfriend. I got that. I just don't know. I don't think it was as big of a deal as they made it to be, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
I mean, maybe I see it as more, and you know, I'm interested to see how much more we learn about Black Hand, but like any elements of her past life in danger.
Right,
the Black Sky programming. So
yeah, we gotta say Black Sky, we're gonna get a lot of tweets.
I've been perfect. Right,
let's be really.
Well, you know,
cognizant.
when they tweet us, I can tweet back with the piece I wrote about my daughter's pretend friend Black Hand, and they will understand why we have the Freudian slip up.
Yes,
how about that? There we go. We have a solution now.
All right.
So, now it's there are things in this episode that kind of make no sense, because again, like you point out, Bakudo, I think, works if you watched Iron Fist. You're like, ooh, he's come. Ooh, it's delightful. Murakami, I question, because you have this guy who, again, he's so, he can jump several yards through a window and ninja away with the best of them at the beginning of an episode, and he hunts and kills predators for fun, and he ninja disappears into thin air after failing to take out Jessica Jones, and he's the one who points out that maybe when you have feelings for your ex, it reduces your effectiveness as a living weapon. But what else? What else is there to you, guy?
Yeah.
You know?
And so this is my question, is like, where is the hand right now? Like, is the hand five ninjas with basically no resources left just scrambling to get by? Like, they have a van with a bunch of guys with guns in them, except those guys are dead now and the van has crashed.
Yeah.
Like, are they five people in this little bunker, or are they still like a giant international conspiracy with hundreds of ninjas and front companies? And like it seems like sometimes the hand is everywhere and it represents thousands of people. And sometimes it's like, no, we have like four, our executive levels are left. And so we have to send like our four secret people who are so impossibly powerful. You've never heard of them before, but now we need to send three of them at a time to get like a random job.
But at the same time, they're not, they placate or actually power reduction when Elektra enters the room. Oh, we have Elektra. We have Black Sky. boom, 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 she can do everything, mm-hmm. which, yeah, I haven't even seen that. Like that, I think that's another
thing. She's not that significantly different than she was when she was alive, except she can apparently survive being hit by a car at this point.
Like, right.
Yeah.
In fact, I would go on record as saying that she seems to be kind of less of a badass mm-hmm. than in D2.
You know, remember in episode 3 when they had the like boring Elektra training sequence and like Elektra yes. killed yes. like six ninjas? Turns out mm-hmm. they needed those six ninjas this episode. So
apparently they like, did.
How many ninjas did Elektra kill for them in her training sequences? And now they're out of ninjas. That was a poor choice. They should have.
That was a poor ninja stewardship. You need to ration your ninjas.
Each of those ninjas, like Bakudo, spent how many hours training them up, and then like you know, like that's just breakfast for Elektra. So
and like, do you think he's really angry that all of those ninjas he trained up are wasted like that? Where he's like, it took me years to develop these ninjas and you just waste them.
Yeah, so. it's unfortunate.
I mean, you know what, but I also did enjoy seeing at the end of it when Stick is like, yeah, you know what, I'm done here, I'm just gonna decapitate somebody.
So one day mm-hmm. possibly fifth best ninja in the world, maybe he's not, you know, positions.
Well, he's
one
clearly
through four
number five because he's dead and one through four are having a conference.
I do have questions about how does immortality work, but you uh-huh. know, chopping a head off, but like he's tied to a chair, like
yeah.
like really, they don't teach the fifth best ninja in the world how to get out of a chair, and like as soon as they knock the chair over, I'm like, he's gonna get out. That's like,
yeah, you guys should watch.
I'll give him this benefit. While he was in the chair, he did his own version of info dump.
So
like
maybe
Stick
he's I want to be here. Is
that, exactly. Yeah. He was trying to pull, you know, mm-hmm. Danny into like, look, you're bigger than what they think you are. You don't have to be this.
My favorite part was when he was like, you may be the dumbest Iron Fist yes. yet. And I love that line for a bunch of reasons. And reason number one is, first, it's always nice when people make fun of Danny. Like it's just delightful. But the second reason I love that line so much is it implies that being dumb is like a feature of an Iron Fist. It's not the Danny Rand bug. Apparently, like it's like a baseline requirement for the job. Are you an Iron Fist? You're probably an idiot who punched a dragon. Is what he's saying there? And I just love the way he tosses that off.
He's not the iron brain.
It feels more believable than all the other things mm-hmm. where it's like posturing about how immortal I am. It's like, no, he believes that you're the dumbest Iron Fist.
Everything else he says,
he's trying to get in your head, but like, no, he just believes that you're the dumbest Iron Fist.
You are the dumbest Iron Fist. Congratulations. Yeah. Well, Madame Gao, there was a version of this scene with Madame Gao back in Iron Fist where Madame Gao gets into everybody's head and just kind of roots around casually for a while. And it remains one of my favorite scenes in that series run. And it was nice to see that kind of callback here, where the idea is when you're immortal, you've had enough time to figure out how human nature works, where you can just kind of casually reach in and wiggle around a few fingers and see how people react. So I liked that a whole lot. I wouldn't say RIP, go on, because he may come back. They all come back. Bakudo tried death and it didn't take. I tried death, it didn't take.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole head from the body thing. I'm going to go ahead and place a bet.
Yeah, but it's pretty exciting. It's pretty exciting seeing that they've started mixing and matching the significant others and people of interest to the Defenders. And it's exciting to see that Luke Cage is angry at this point now. And Elektra, there appear to be some cracks in her programming. So I feel like what we've done is we've probably, if episode 4 was the Defenders come together, what we're seeing now are all the complications that arise in Act mm-hmm. 2. And I'm looking forward to seeing how long Act 2 lasts.
Yeah, I think I was not mm-hmm. as into this episode as either of you, mm-hmm. but I think you're helping me see the value in it. And it's hard. I liked episode 4 so much that I think it was going to be hard for something to compete with that. And the fight scene in episode 3 was, you know, that was what I'm here for. So mm-hmm. this episode was kind of lacking on both of those, but I see where it's headed. And I don't know. My hopes are up for episode 6, which I haven't seen yet. So.
Yeah, Tony, here's the thing. Here's why. Like there are some lulls in episode 5. The takeaway for me is this is the reason why our Defenders do what they do, mm-hmm. and they are protecting their own. And, you know, it's not all the reason, but it's like, when it comes to my front lawn, mm-hmm. I'm going to protect, you know, those inside my house. And so, like, each of these have these significant people that are important to them. And it actually then shows you that there's a bigger, mm-hmm. you know, there's a bigger network going on. I mean, we knew that already, but, like, you know, but just by having those relationships are so key to each of these people. And I'll go a step further, and this is why I kind of F the Avengers, mm-hmm. is they don't seem to have that. Mm-hmm. It's like it's with each other, but they don't have any kind of people with them, people mm-hmm. that care about them.
Yeah.
The closest thing that they had, strike me if I'm wrong, but was Hawkeye with his wife.
Hawkeye with his family, yeah.
I think there are some, but like they totally don't appear when it's inconvenient for there to be, because there's too many characters, right? Like
no, yeah. and I feel like Hawkeye's family was basically used because they had to find some way to give that guy more screen time than he got in the first Avengers,
right,
and
right.
it was like, well, give him a family, I guess.
I think
not saying the Avengers need families. I'm just saying that
they need
where...
they need some sort of something that ties them to the world they're defending is the thing. And
I think I'm staggering from the scene where the Hand has a meeting. That's what kind of mm-hmm. throws me. And I guess this, I mean, maybe that is like, well, things are
very
different.
Where is the
now.
Plate of bagels? Where
but
is
like,
the plate of bagels? Where is the coffee?
You guys, the Hand, like, I feel like two episodes ago, the Hand was this, like, elemental force and, like, mm-hmm. full of secrets and shadow spookily unknown stuff. And they had to kind of finally reveal stuff. And we got an info dump from Stick and we got some more information from Sewanee this episode. But, like... And I see where they're going for the storyline, but there's still something about, like, let's have a scene about infighting between these four ninja masters in a meeting mm-hmm. that really kind of, like, it takes a lot of the mystery out of the equation. And
Well, and, you know. Like, even when Danny in episode 3, which I wasn't around for, but, you know, mm-hmm. he goes into a boardroom and bullshit. Oh, everybody's a ninja? Come on.
Oh my gosh, like, that was the best though, because I kept wondering how much corporate America would change if the boards were actually if you fired all the people who are on them
now change a lot
and filled them with ninjas. You know, sorry, captains of industry, you're out from now on. It's an all ninja board. I get what you're saying, where you're like, now, you know, they were more that the Hand was more fun when it was a bunch of shadowy people and they all seem to have their own thing going on. And another thing that occurs to me is if they've known each other for as long as they have, like, they should loathe each other at this point. They should just be angry and bored with one another. Like, somebody should have tried to kill somebody else a long time ago, and that hasn't happened yet. And
I feel like for that reason, you don't have meetings. So,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
You stay away from each other.
Like, if we had, like, a throwaway line from Bakuda who's like, I stay in South America so I don't try to kill you all, you know, like, that would have been worth
it. And I guess maybe you can't do this efficiently, and having a meeting scene is an efficient way to do stuff, but, like, imagine if instead of that we'd had, like, a series of scenes with different pairs of the operatives of the Hand kind of having a conversation / arguing with each other, but, like, it becomes very clear that, like, oh, yeah, Madame Gao and Alexandra can be in the same room together, but Madame Gao is never going to be in the same room as Murakami, and you know, and Bakuto will talk to Madame Gao, but won't talk to so and so. And like, instead, it's like, nope, they're all together mm-hmm. having a meeting where they're squabbling about, you know, organizational politics. And it's like, really, you guys run the world? Like, mm-hmm.
yeah.
What are your action items for this? Who's taking
liars?
Notes? And this comes out, and they could have solved this with like a series of webisodes or a series of cartoons or something. Like, how do they decide who got what continent other than, you know, deep seated racism?
It seems like that's it, right? I think it said they went back to their homes, and somehow, I guess, Alexandra is the leader, mm-hmm. and also, is America hers, or is America, like, up for grabs, because none of them is from America?
Yeah, that's the thing that I'm not clear on, because I was like, did Gao get America because Murakami made it clear Asia was his? But she's got
operations
in Asia.
But not
Asia,
right? It's they've got Japan and China, right? So it's
yeah, exactly.
Asia.
So... Yeah. So there's that level of confusion. And then how did they handle World War II? Because it's not like Japan and China were on the same side in any remote way, shape, or form there. And
you're putting an element of reality that I'm just not going to accept.
I'm back into the weeds where the problem you always have with an organization where the members are thousands upon thousands of years old is either they have to be so far removed from the flow of history that it genuinely startles everybody when they turn out to be effective, or they have to be proven to have shaped that flow of history somehow, and this Hand mm-hmm. has really done neither. Like, there's been some allusions with, oh, remember Pompeii, or whatever, mm-hmm. but we haven't seen anything laid down anywhere, and they haven't made any sort of attempt to try to convince us that this all-powerful organization did anything to either profit from events, stay out of events, or shape events. Like, it's like they've
popped
in.
They're not a sublight Hydra.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like they've popped in from a parallel universe with this, oh, yes, we're immortal and we change things. And they'll pop out again. Well, and I'm all, eh, I don't get
it. It's tricky.
It's all weird in Kunlun.
Yeah. It's tricky with the eternal powers and how do you, you know. I have to say, so the Assassin's Creed video games depict, like, mm-hmm. this eternal war between, like, the Templars and the Assassins. And mm-hmm. one of the games that was particularly interesting was there's one of them set during the Revolutionary War. And, like, the first mm-hmm. question you have is, like, well, which side? Who's on which side? And the answer is that, like, they both have people on different sides and are just trying to play it out. You know, they are influencing the course of events and not that they have a particular side. But, yeah, it's, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. I don't know. Ancient cults.
So, and I want to say, I did enjoy it. I especially enjoyed Bakuda because I'm like, oh my God, I know this guy. But, you know, I'm looking forward to episode 6 and 7 to see how it plays out. I think we've basically bottomed this one out. So, shall we call it a day?
Everything. Yeah, we've covered what we need to.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank everybody from The Incomparable who's been listening along with us. And you are more than welcome to tweet your interpretations of what's going on and tell us what we might have missed. And let's wrap it up. I was Lisa Schmeiser, and with me as always, we're Phil Mozeliak.
Hey, we'll see you later.
And Tony Sindelar.
Goodbye, nerds.
There we go.